This is Icon Art Radio. I'm Bill Teeple. I'm here with my co-host, Alan Cobb. And our guest today is Tony Ellis, a local artist and photographer. We'll get to this a little bit later. We were talking about if you can't even talk about whether a person's a photographer or a painter or anything anymore. The lines are so blurred now. But in any case, we have an artist, and we don't even know if we can call people artists anymore. Remember, many books have been written about the end of art. It's over. The grand narrative of art is over. And so I guess that leaves us just with the creative process goes on, and we can't help ourselves. But we'll get to that. First of all, welcome to the show, Tony.
Hello. Great to be here.
So Tony's going to be giving a talk on June 20th at Icon.
2013,
if this is a repeat show, somewhere in the future. And so I wanted him to come and clue us in a little bit to what he's got going on and what he's going to talk about. He has been selected as the feature artist of the Fairfield Fair Fest, organized by KRUU and James Moore, that will be at the Arts and Convention Center. And so he will have art there. He will also have art at the new Gallery 52 that's opening on Briggs Street. And he'll talk a little bit about that. And he'll have work in both venues during the Fair Fest, which I think is launched that day, the 20th, and it goes through the weekend.
Correct, yeah.
Okay. And all right, well, tell us a little bit about what's going on.
Well, Fair Fest is, as you said, it's organized by KRUU, the local radio station. I think it's principally a music festival, but it also has a theme of self-sustainability. So there are going to be speakers about self-sustainability. There's going to be music playing, outdoor vendors, and two or three blocks of downtown Fairfield will be closed off. And the idea is to, as I understand it, this is the first one, and they want to turn this into an annual event and make it bigger till it takes over the whole downtown for a weekend and brings a lot of people from outside. And the people organizing it asked if I would, if they could, have an art show as part of the weekend. And the reason being, well, hopefully they like my work, but also there's a kind of a link because my work is photographic, but we'll come to that subject of whether it's photograph or paintings later on. But because the work is very abstract in nature, although it's photographic. But most of the images I captured have been over the past 5 years while I've been working as a land agent for sustainable energy projects out in Colorado and California. And I just started taking photographs for fun while I was traveling around these very remote desert areas, and then later on spending a lot of time in Los Angeles and finding really great images in the back streets of Venice Beach and Marina del Rey and places like that, and South Central LA and all over the place. So the talk I'm giving, which kicks off this exhibition, is at Icon on Thursday the 20th, and I called it Art, Beauty, and the Environment. And I wanted to link in the idea that care for the environment is really something that is enhanced, or it's encouraged, when you become connected to the environment. And I think the artist has a role in connecting people to the environment, because he highlights, for one thing, beauty in the external world through his view of it, his perception, and then he presents it in such a way that the people who are looking at the piece of art feel that same connection. And I think that's the only way you can really create a self-sustainable environment where people care for their environment, is if they feel a connection to it. I think the artist has a very, very important role to play in that respect. Whether it's music, painting, photography, whatever, it's this connection on the level of people's awareness that the artist can help, I think.
I have to say that what you're doing with these photographs of and you're not necessarily telling pictures of the birds and the flowers and all these things that like connect people up with the nature. These are sort of dilapidated old buildings and train tracks and trains and all of that kind of thing. And a lot of people have done this. This is kind of a especially people that they sort of get turned on to photography, which is a way of capturing imagery. And then they also seem to, at the same time, often get turned on to the abstract nature of the forms in front of their face. And this, and then sort of a kind of aha goes off, and then you see a lot of photography. But what I want to say about Tony's is that this is the creme de la creme. This, he's got the eye for this. So these pieces are stunning and magnificent.
Yeah, it's one thing I want to bring out in the talk is I think several threads in my life have come together in this work. One is, as a kid, I was always fascinated by found objects. And so I would spend all my days when I was a child wandering around finding interesting stuff, bits of old rusted steel, pram wheels, you name it. I'd root around and find stuff. Then I went to art school and did 4 years studying art. My principal subject turned out...
Where did you go?
That was in... it's now called University of West England. Mm-hmm. It was in the city of Bristol in West England. My major subject there was actually sculpture, but again, I was using natural materials, paper, wood. I was doing things outside, installing them outside in the environment, or creating art that actually enhanced like the interior design as well. So it just wasn't art on the wall kind of thing. It was always related to some kind of environment. And then, you know, you fast forward 20, 25 years spent doing, practicing transcendental meditation and studying this whole field of expanding your consciousness and awareness, where I wasn't really doing art per se. But what I realized is when I came back to creating art again, which I said was, in this case, was almost by accident. I just started taking photographs and suddenly started discovering really interesting images. I think I have to acknowledge that it's all the time spent looking inside through the meditation practice that actually enhanced the perception outside and somehow made me see something magical in even the most mundane of places. So like you said, I'm wandering around rusty old trains out in the desert, decaying back streets in West Coast cities like Los Angeles. And the more I looked, the more I started to find these little gems. And I've always been really interested in abstract art. So I was starting to, the frame of the camera was starting to frame images that to me were just like Mark Rothko paintings off the shelf, so to speak. And I, like you said, you start to look closer and closer. And then I've taken a lot of images, and now there's a connection between what I'm photographing and in a very sort of personal way, in the sense that they seem to be almost going, hey, over here, take a photograph of me. It's almost like they're alive. And I really don't change the framing of the images very much at all. I see them, I like them the way I see them. I take a picture, and that pretty much, apart from maybe minimal trimming of the image, is how I want it.
So you don't alter them much in Photoshop, but you are shooting digital.
I'm shooting digital, I'm shooting at a high resolution. The only things I do in terms of Photoshop is I tweak the color. I maybe boost the color up a little bit, because there's always a problem translating the color that you see, the color in the camera, the color on the computer where it's backlit, and the printed image. So I do work on that. And I do have a program that enhances the quality, the digital, the pixels, so that I can boost up the resolution and print them bigger. And I'm also, with the images now, I'm printing them large, maybe 3 feet by 4 or 5 feet. I'm printing them on canvas, stretching them, and then I'm going in and working the surface of them with acrylic gels. Not really changing the color, they're clear gels, but what I'm doing is I'm giving them a texture.
So the gels mainly the texture yeah. for the texture, rather than yeah. toning.
Yeah,
right. Okay. And it takes away the flatness of a photograph. And in a sense, it's a little bit like trompe l'oeil, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, trompe l'oeil.
Yeah.
Sounds good to me.
Yeah. It's always been the tricky one.
Wait. We've that's got the American... Snooty Artist Society over here.
No, that's the American pronunciation of the French, or okay, good. The English pronunciation of the French.
For those who don't know about Snooty Artist, what's the website for snootyartists.com?
Oh, Snooty Artists, yeah, Snooty Artists Guild.
Right. Oh, okay.
Something everyone should know about.
Well, the English have never been good at pronouncing any other language except their own, so I'll take a pass. But basically, it convinces the viewer about the images more than just a flat image, and it makes it more real. And in some cases, if some particular highlight didn't come out really well on the photograph, I'll actually enhance that highlight with paint, with color. But it's really the same as on the original image. It's not changing anything. I like the honesty of the images I found.
Right, yeah, I really like that too.
There's always a debate anyway. I mean, within the artist, it doesn't matter if there's a debate in the newspaper about the difference between what's capable of being reproduced and what you saw. And who's the landscape photographer that we've
here in town
talked to? Yeah.
Ken West.
Yeah, Ken West. He does these beautiful high resolution landscape portraits, really, that look like they've been highly doctored up and perfected and stuff, and they really haven't been. He's using HDR, high dynamic range, to fill in the shadow detail and so forth. But he's doing it so that you can actually see reproduced in ink or pigment what you remember seeing when you were there. You can see the human looks at the sun and he looks at the snow and he looks at the trees and he sees the shadows when he's looking at the trees and his eyes stop down when he's looking at the sun. And you can't do that with a camera unless you do multiple exposures and start playing with it. And the results are almost hyper-real.
Mm-hmm. People think they've been really manipulated.
Yeah, and in a sense...
They don't realize that what they think of as a photograph is the look of a photograph, and that's exactly. realistic to them. You think.
Yeah, it's like we've gotten used to 24 frames per second flickering in a movie, and nothing looks like that in the real world.
Yeah, until the point where, you know, high-definition TV and Blu-ray players, it's even though it's actually accurately representing the way things look, it's not convincing anymore because the mystery that was in the sort of slight fuzziness taken away. But actually, they're just accurately reproducing real life.
Yeah, and that goes back to the artist who should be the cinematographer who should know how to use that infinite resolution correctly. It's not supposed to be crisp and hard-edged and perfectly focused and absolutely crystal clear at all times. It's like what we've always seen.
If it takes the illusion away, if instead of seeing a fantasy world, you see an actor in a studio, then you've destroyed the illusion.
Yeah, as soon as you see the Scotch tape on the props,
and the nostril hairs,
it's not the bridge of the Enterprise anymore.
Well, that's the whole thing about, it's all about perspective, and cultures become habitual about what perspective is real and what perspective is not.
Yeah.
I mean, we accept that a shadow on a face is a real representation of a face, but the shadow doesn't actually exist, except in certain lighting conditions. And if the person moves, the shadow moves. Whereas some traditions of art, they didn't put shadows in because they wanted to represent the realistic person.
Yeah.
Middle East art takes the perspective always looking down from the sky because they want to see the world the way God sees it.
Yeah.
And that was perfectly acceptable to them.
Sure.
So I think you've got the same thing now with electronic technology.
Yeah.
What perspective is acceptable and what's not? What's convincing and what's not?
Yeah. And a lot more dimensions to play with and tools for playing with them.
Well, there's no doubt artists are going to start producing 3D images that just hover in the middle of the room.
Yeah.
Is that realistic or not?
Yeah. And is realistic even worth mentioning, you know.
Like, I mean, I think the bottom line is, does it please? Does it excite? Mm-hmm. Does it stimulate something in the viewer that somehow expands his experience?
Yeah.
So really the artist is always enhancing something.
Yeah.
I think.
And the artist, I think, is always moving on too. The viewer has to tag along if it's interesting enough to hold their attention.
See, I resist having people describe my work as photography, even though it's taken with a camera, because it creates a mindset that it's supposed to look a certain way. I'd rather people looked at it, and then you can say, well, actually, that was a photograph, and that produces a really moment, a sort of aha moment, which is kind of fun for people, I think.
Yeah.
But quite what you'd call it, I don't know. How would you describe
what you do?
Yeah, I mean, if you try to classify it, I've had this discussion with gallery owners, how to classify it in terms of what art movement it would belong to.
Well, I think the problem is classification. We get stuck in classification.
Yeah, right.
And you just said what artists do is they enhance experience for someone else, or they bring someone else's attention to something, or this mysterious thing called beauty, we skirt around and dance around and we celebrate it together, and that's kind of what art's all about. And so the art historians and the academics and people that write books and things like to classify everything and name it and then make stories about those movements. And now it gets very easily away from any kind of direct experience.
Well, that's when you get into the whole world experience. Of do the art critics actually direct the art world, or do the artists direct the art world? That's a dangerous ground.
I think the art critics direct the art market.
Right.
And the artists do whatever the heck artists do.
Yeah, the artists just keep doing what they do, and the new media and stuff comes along, and they play with any way to get some image across, or feeling inside across, or any experience across. So all my young, you know, so many of the young people today are sitting in the park drawing, the romance of drawing, only they're doing it on a tablet. They're not using pencil and paper is kind of like the slate and the stick or the chalk of the past, you know.
Right.
So things change, and the certain romantic things that you're stuck on, you know, in your mind and in your reality, you hate to see them go away, but then things have been changing and they always change.
Although there is something to be said about involving different sensory and mechanical.
Oh, yeah, don't get me things. Going. Yeah, I teach drawing with the pencil on the paper.
I love drawing. I love
and
writing.
And to lose is, I think, maybe the next generation of kids is going to feel a loss of some sort. Yeah. When one of those kids in 30 years picks up a pencil and applies the B pencil and then the 6B pencil and then the piece of charcoal to a piece of paper, the aesthetic experience of doing it is they're going to go, wow. And they got to run out and tell people, you know, there's this thing, you can put the pencil on the paper and it's so cool.
Yeah.
And then, oh, you know, we like our tablet, you know.
Well, we actually did a study where to do with writing anyway. Because I write poetry and I can't write the poetry on the computer. I have to write it by hand and then translate it to the computer. And they actually found out that when you write by hand, you use the creative side of the brain. And when you use a computer, you're using the more mechanical side of the brain.
Completely.
So there is a thing about creativity.
I wrote a book several years ago that I was expecting to be so filled with exciting ideas that I would have to go as fast as possible, and I rented a Selectric, and the first thing I noticed was that the hum of the Selectric was demanding that I hurry up, and I didn't like that. It wasn't contributing anything to the process. Then I realized that although I can type in, if I don't mind making mistakes, 120 words per minute, I still think 4 times as fast as that, so it's not really helping. And I'm so busy with the writing and focusing on it so hard that the management of the technology was overshadowing my ability to float on the ideas and go deep into them. So I switched to handwriting on a yellow pad, And then I discovered that it was critically important to be able to look back at what I had just written and glance at it to keep in the context. And I couldn't read it because I was scribbling so fast. So then I switched to writing on a yellow pad neatly. And that slowed me down, you know, by a factor of four again, so that I was going very slowly. And when an idea came and I was in the middle of another idea, I just had to say, I hope you come back. If you're worthwhile, I hope you return. And now when I'm writing poetry, I can't even write it. I do it out loud. I improvise it into a recorder, and then I transcribe it and look at it on paper.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because I write it and it comes in my head,
yeah,
and I have to write it out. But I have to write it out by hand first.
Yeah.
But, for example, they've got technology now for flying these high-speed military jets where the pilots are basically controlling them through thought. It's mm-hmm. picking up on their thoughts and translate, because mm-hmm. their reaction time has to be so fast they can't do it mechanically.
Yeah.
I mean, is there going to be a day when the artist can just think something and it will manifest?
Yeah, the seed idea is all you need. I didn't even know what it was. And then, bam, it popped out into the materializer.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, then you're getting down to the realm of the actual divine principle that just manifests from his own desire to see something fascinating, basically. Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing. It's all based on some form of desire. And that's what, you know, the kids who are preferring the tablet over the pencil right now, part of that is because the target of their attention is the finished product rather than the process. And if I want a picture of a superhero, then I want tools that will get me a superhero as quickly and easily as possible. If what I want is to get immersed in the process of seeing some sort of ineffable creative energy move from the indescribable silence out into the perceptible world, then, you know, any medium will do. And I'm not thinking about the end product. I'm actually amazed by the end product.
Well, yeah, I mean, the technology is giving you a new kind of stereotyping, especially animation mm-hmm. technology, where there's a certain convention that just developing almost by consensus that a person, you know, an animated person looks like this, an animated squirrel looks like that. But that's what always happens in art. There becomes, for a while, a certain way to paint somebody, a certain way to draw somebody is acceptable. It's just a different stage.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when Walt Disney type cartooning that we saw, the flat cartoon, not the stuff they're doing today with digital animation. There were people that bemoaned that look because they were so into the look of the original illustrations in the children's books that were so, you know, well drawn. I mean, it was all obvious drawing and volumes and crustiness and all this. And
lighting.
Then the figures, the Walt Disney's figures were so like clean and stuff.
Yeah.
Well, I have that same kind of like feeling about these animated cartoons. Everything is all smooth and round. There's no like dirty detail
There's
at
no
all.
Flaws.
It's all round. And so I remember people because I was young and I was into Walt Disney and I thought, oh, those are old-fashioned. Those are sort of, I don't
clumsy.
Like those old illustrations.
Right.
I like this nice, clean Walt Disney stuff. So it is realities that we start to live in and conventions take hold.
Yeah,
right. Isn't that the nature of the human being to have its form? It's just human beings form habits and then... But then again, the artists are often the people
who
break those.
When the artist is the one that works on the edge of the envelope and starts forging new ground.
Because I'm bored with this, I want to try something different, and then the conventions change. But there's always a period of convention about anything that becomes popular anyway.
So let me just say, I don't know where we are in time here, but we're actually getting towards the end. I should have, in the middle of this show, said, this is KRUU FM 100.1.
We always try to remember to do that. But one out of every 10
Icon
shows.
And it's Icon Art Radio that's going on here. And we're in Alan Cobb and
I are
interviewing Tony Ellis. If you've wondered who this talking head is or this voice coming across the airwaves. All right, so we're getting towards the end here. Let's Have we said what we need to say? We've got the lecture on June 20th at ICON.
There's a lecture on 20th, then the show.
And 2013.
The show starts on the 21st and runs through the 23rd in the Sondheim. There's going to be some pieces. There's not a lot of display area in the Sondheim available, so just a few pieces there. The rest will be across the road on this new gallery, Art 52, which is opposite the courthouse on Briggs, just one of that brick building that used to be a dance studio, I think. And
how long will the show be there?
There it'll run for four or five weeks, I believe. So it'll be through the July art walk and into July, and then it will probably change for the August art walk.
And this is started up by Dale Stevens Group?
Yeah, the gallery is started up by Robert Reeder and Dale Stevens have a fine art printing company, and basically they're offering, there's only probably I think a handful of companies in the country that are doing very high resolution scanning and printing of artwork. So they started off photographing people's art and then reproducing it as prints for them. And they have very high resolution scanners, 400 megapixel resolution, so they can get fabulous detail. And they have these large scale Giclée printers, and they can print on paper or canvas and so forth, and they stretch it. And then they have a website. They're particularly focusing on Fairfield artists at the moment. I came in as a new element to the mixture where I already have the photograph, and so they're basically just printing them for me. And then they want to set up this physical gallery to also to display, showcase the work, and my work is going to be the first show for that.
I've noticed that the fidelity of their prints are top, are very close to the original, and this has always been the problem.
Right.
So, which brings up another issue that we should have another show to discuss, pretty much, and that's that the line between original works of art and reproductions has gotten blurred in recent years because of this high quality reproductions that can be, they have art, the reproductions themselves have art quality now.
Right.
Well, thanks for joining us. Everyone,
pleasure.
Enjoy the Fair Fest in 20th through the 23rd, 2013 here in Fairfield. Come on down if you're out of town.
You've been listening to ICON Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.